Knowledge Products presents Mutual Funds as part of a series of presentations on Secrets of the Great Investors, narrated by Louis Rutheiser.
Though barely noticed at the time, the Massachusetts Investors Trust was incorporated on March 21, 1924, a day now regarded as the birth date of American mutual funds. For decades, most investors failed to recognize the full impact of this innovation. However, a 1925 article in the Harvard Business Review outlined some features of public investment pools, such as the expertise of professional investment managers, that would later attract millions of American investors.
The small investor is in no position to make wise selections from a variety of investments, for this is a business requiring considerable training and ability, which the small investor does not possess. Professional managers may be expected to have both the training and the time necessary to make a careful study of investments. This expert advice is at the disposal of the small investor, and he can make use of it. It gives him the benefit of the training and experience of men whose business it is to know about investments.
The Harvard Business Review went on to say that public investment pools also could deliver instant diversification.
It tends to make for a greater degree of safety in investments by means of a degree of diversification not otherwise available except to the large investor. The small investor, because of the small amount of money he has available for investment, is unable to diversify his investments to any extent. He's more or less obliged to put his egg in one basket. But when he purchases securities of a diversified portfolio, he, in effect, breaks the content of his egg among many baskets, resulting in an added degree of safety. Because while some of the securities in the diversified portfolio may go bad, others may be going good. Moreover, the managers are continually looking after the contents of the several baskets, thereby securing to the small investor the eternal vigilance which is just as necessary as the judicious selection of investments.
The Massachusetts Investors Trust, later known as MIT, was diversified and professionally managed, as were many other funds. But the MIT was famous for other revolutionary practices that later became standard policies among mutual funds. One of them was the concept of share redemption, which allowed fund shareholders to redeem their shares on demand. Funds offering share redemption were first known as Boston-style funds, a nod to the fact that most such funds were formed and managed in Boston. Later, however, such funds came to be known as open-end, as opposed to the closed-end variety available before. Fund expert Thomas Hirschfeld explains the difference.
Closed-end funds do not continually offer new shares for sale to the investing public. Closed-end funds issue a fixed amount of stock. In this respect, they are just like any industrial firm or utility, which essentially always has the same number of shares outstanding. Closed-end funds trade in the open market exactly like the shares of any publicly traded company. In contrast, an investor purchases an open-end fund from the fund itself or through its sales agents, and when the investor sells his or her shares, they are redeemed by the fund. But trading in a closed-end fund, either on the buy or sell side, is done in the open market, on the stock exchanges, or in the over-the-counter markets.
A second innovation from the Massachusetts Investors Trust involved the idea of pricing shares based on net asset value. The price on any given day is simply the total assets of the fund divided by the number of outstanding shares in the fund. This is an important difference between open-end and closed-end funds, as Thomas Herzfeld explains.
The net asset value per share, or NAV as it is called, means the total net asset of the fund divided by the number of its outstanding shares. Shares are bought and sold at their net asset value. Shares in a closed-end fund, it must be remembered constantly, are not redeemed at their net asset value, as are shares in the open-end funds. Rather, they are bought and sold at the price the general market places on them. And that price could be at net asset value, above it, or, as is often the case, below it, meaning at discounts.
Despite the ready convenience of redeeming open-end shares at full net asset value, the closed-end funds continued to dominate the fund world for more than two decades. The Massachusetts Investors Trust and other open-end funds constantly had to sell new shares as some investors redeemed shares. So the MIT's founders introduced the idea of a sales fee, charged to the investor and paid to a salesperson or broker. This fee came to be known as a load, and in the 1920s it was as high as 10%. Years later, government regulations capped loads at 8.5%, and load funds dominated the open-end category until the no-load fund became popular in the 1970s. No-load funds were sold directly by the fund company without a sales charge, and in the 1970s they quickly gained a toehold against load funds. During the 1980s and 1990s, mutual funds grew dramatically, both in size and number, and the issue of sales charges and fees became more and more complex. The idea of a load or no-load fund often became blurred, as brokerage firms created new ways to promote load funds against the increasingly popular no-load funds. Fund watcher and advisor Gerald Perrett points out,
selecting funds sold by brokerage firms is a little like searching through alphabet soup. These firms have developed a hub-and-spoke approach to marketing their funds. The hub is the investment portfolio, while the spokes emanating from that hub offer a variety of alternative sales fee payment plans. Class A shares are sold with a front-end load. Class B shares are sold without a front-end load. Instead, the investor pays an ongoing charge and a redemption fee when exiting the fund. Some brokerage firms now offer Class C, Class D, and Class E shares in addition to the front-end load or redemption fee options.
During the 1980s and 1990s, terms such as redemption fee, front-end load, no load, closed-end, open-end, and NAV became part of the daily vocabulary of millions of Americans. In 1980, only 6% of U.S. households owned shares in mutual funds. By 1996, that figure grew to 36%, a six-fold increase in only 16 years. In 1980, there were 564 funds. The count rose to 3,400 by 1991 and nearly 8,000 funds in 1996, grouped into hundreds of different types or categories. Mutual fund assets grew from $293 billion in 1983 to $1 trillion in 1990 and more than $3 trillion in 1997. In part, the growth of mutual funds represented a massive shift in investor behavior, from direct involvement in stock ownership to mediated involvement, or involvement by proxy through mutual funds. This shift was clearly noticeable in a 1986 Wall Street Journal report.
Small investors, widely considered Wall Street's endangered species, may have simply changed the way they play the investment game. The surge in mutual funds indicates that small investors haven't really fled the investment market, as some analysts have suggested. A recent study by the New York Stock Exchange acknowledges that direct share ownership by individuals has dropped since its previous survey in 1983, but it contends that small investors are still buying equities, largely through mutual funds. Small investors, in short, aren't dead. just changed. Many of them have quit battling the institutions in the market and have joined them.
This trend continued, and by the 1990s, American stock ownership shifted from majority ownership by individuals to majority ownership by institutions. By 1990, mutual fund assets exceeded the assets held in savings institutions. Only 2 years later, in 1992, mutual fund assets exceeded the assets of savings institutions and life insurance companies combined. Looking back, the path from the birth of the American Mutual Fund in 1924 to its widespread acceptance in the late 20th century was not completely smooth. The basic concept went through some trying periods when professional management and diversification failed to overcome disappointing market results for small investors. As we'll see in more detail, the history of the mutual fund idea underscores the strengths and weaknesses, opportunities and risks of a financial instrument, the mutual fund, that continually evolves. The 1920s was a decade of unquestioning exuberance in the stock market, and this mood touched virtually every corner of the financial world. The concept we know today as the mutual fund was in its infancy, riding a roller coaster, like every other investment vehicle, from dizzying heights of popularity to the depths of disgrace and scandal. Known popularly as investment trusts, the public investment pool in America was a concept borrowed from the British, and it was quite different from the informal pools formed by people who knew one another. The British had begun the investment trust movement during the last part of the 19th century, enabling smaller investors to participate in rapidly growing foreign markets, particularly the United States. Great Britain had been a supreme financial power up through the early 20th century. But in the aftermath of World War I, England and the rest of Europe lay in chaos, and the U.S. took England's place as the world's financial leader. At the same time, more Americans were becoming affluent and looking for more sophisticated ways to make money from investments, just as affluent Britons had done in the 19th century. John Moody, the founder of Moody's Investors Services, observed the changing scene in 1925 for Forbes magazine.
Only in recent years has it been possible to give serious consideration to investment policies for the masses of people of all grades of income and in all walks of life in this country. Prior to the World War, about the only sane advice that could be given to the average man in the street, with no particular amount of investment capital, but with a little saving ability, was to advise him to put his savings in the savings bank and get the 4% interest which most banks of this character pay. But in recent years, there have begun to be developed in this country what are known as investment trusts. These investment trusts are devised primarily for the small investor. This system of investing small sums through investment trusts has been developed to a large degree in Europe during the last 25 to 30 years. In England alone, there are hundreds of investment trusts.
In 1925, a mere handful of American investment trusts existed, with only a few thousand investors. But the idea quickly became more popular. By 1927, there were about 100 investment trusts, with approximately 50,000 investors, and a total investment value of roughly $350 million. The investment trust movement then grew tenfold as the bull market raged in 1928 and 1929, and the number of shareholders grew tenfold to over 500,000 investors, or about 10% of American households. In early 1929, new investment trusts were being formed at the rate of one a day. The total valuation of investment trust shares grew to more than $8 billion, a growth of more than 25 times their valuation only 2 years earlier. At the time of the 1929 crash, there were 755 investment trusts, up from 100 only 2 years earlier. Part of this mania for investment trusts simply echoed the feverish attitude of the time. Though it was rarely expressed in public, small investors saw the investment trust as a way to get in on the action. Many wanted to participate in the pool manipulation of stock prices and to profit from the insider trading occurring on glamorous Wall Street during the 1920s. Financial historian Robert Sobel recalls the atmosphere.
That stocks were being manipulated and rigged was no secret. Pirates like Jesse Livermore, Arthur Cutten, the Fisher Brothers, Joe Kennedy and others organized bull and bear pools to push hot stocks up or down. The small investors fairly yearned to be in on such groups, but of course they were on the outside, and in any case lacked capital for such ventures. It was for the likes of them that investment trusts appeared.
Wall Street also promoted the investment trust as a virtually risk-free way to be involved in the stock market. An added boost came when college and university professors, such as economics professor Irving Fisher of Yale University, made highly publicized endorsements. Fisher tirelessly promoted the investment trust idea and gained a great deal of notice throughout the 1920s. He delivered countless speeches, articles, and books extolling the virtues of investment trusts. Typical was this 1929 declaration.
The investment trust principle operates to shift risks from those who lack investment knowledge to those who possess it. As a consequence, normally speculative properties gravitate into the hands of these skilled agencies better able to forecast their true future value. Investment trusts buy when there is real anticipation of a rise due to underlying causes, and sell when there is a real anticipation of a fall. They buy at prices less than the true worth of the securities purchased, taking advantage of their superior knowledge of industrial and trading conditions.
Despite Fisher's confident claims, the risk did not shift from those who lacked investment knowledge to those who possessed it. In fact, the risk stayed with the investor in the investment trust, just as risk stays with today's holder of mutual funds. Today's mutual fund holders generally understand this. But in early 1929, many investors didn't recognize that they were bearing risk. This was overlooked as markets rose spectacularly year after year. An investment trust could and did claim that no investment trust shareholder had ever lost a dime. The investment trust mania during the 1920s was not focused on the open-end Boston-style trusts like the Massachusetts Investors Trust. Instead, the frenzy centered almost exclusively on closed-end trusts for several reasons. One was that most closed-end trusts were formed and sold by brokerage houses. These trusts paid high brokers' fees and produced brokerage profits from revenues associated with underwriting the trusts. By contrast, the open-end trusts, even with a sales load of 10%, were less profitable to sell. The closed-end trusts also attracted buyers because they were literally mystery stocks. The closed-end funds would not divulge their holdings, and this secrecy sparked the speculative juices of small investors. Closed-end trusts also used heavy leverage, buying stocks on margin. This achieved extraordinary results while the market was on the rise. Author John Wagoner, in his book Money Madness, elaborates.
Being in a highly leveraged fund can be a wonderful thing when the stock market is on the way up, which it certainly was in 1928 and the bulk of 1929. Some of the trusts racked up spectacular gains on the way up, but for the majority, the ride up was very brief. Since many of the trusts, about 600 of them, came into being in 1929, their share prices had nowhere to go but down when Wall Street walked off a cliff. The shares of the Public Utilities Holding Corporation of America, for instance, came out at about $36 a share, fell to $20 by the end of 1929, staggered up to $25 during the Suckers Rally of 1930, and then swooned to under $1 per share by 1934.
For one trust, the Founders Group, the power of leverage helped to push a $1,000 investment in 1925 to a high of $10,500 in 1929, and then to $32 in 1932. As John Wagoner explains, trust investors were paying premium prices.
Most of the closed-end trusts in the late 1920s sold for considerable premiums over their real values. Investors were willing to pay a dollar and a half for every dollar the trust actually had. Part of the reason, of course, was the nation's love affair with the stock market. The other reason was because the trusts were, after all, run by big professional players who knew the market. The highest flyers commanded the biggest premiums. For the Goldman Sachs Trading Corporation, buyers were willing to pay $2 for every $1 the trust controlled. The Central States Electric Utilities Corporation got $3 for every $1 in assets.
Added to the high cost was the practice of buying shares on margin, sometimes with margin loans provided by the investment trusts themselves. In 1929, the investment trusts rarely differentiated themselves by their investment objectives or past performance. Instead, they were separated into categories based on the amount of leverage they used: high leverage, medium leverage, or no leverage. Later, in the 1930s, when government investigators looked into the performance of the investment trusts, their final report showed,
by the end of 1937, the average dollar which had been invested in July 1929 in the index of leveraged investment company stock was 5 cents, while the non-leveraged dollar was worth 48 cents.
The Boston-style investment trusts were disclosing their holdings and valuing their shares based on the actual market value of investments. So they lacked the romance or mystery that propelled so much of the 1920s bull market. Their funds also redeemed at full value, so it was impossible to run up the price of the shares. And few open-end funds used leverage, so their results lagged in the bull market, and few investors were drawn to them. Of the 755 investment trusts existing when the market crashed in October 1929, only 19 were of the open-end Boston style. And out of some $8 billion of investment trust shares that encountered the great crash, only $150 million, or less than 2%, was in the Boston-style open-end trusts. Over time, the ingredient that proved most detrimental to the closed-end trusts was not the overuse of leverage. It was their investment secrecy. Contrary to the claims of promoters like Irving Fisher, many of the trusts were not properly diversifying among widely traded stocks and bonds. Investigations later revealed that some of the trusts had ended up as a dumping ground for worthless stocks bought from the trust managers themselves. Other trusts had made risky investments in oil and gas exploration or in new unseasoned companies. In the wake of the crash, all this collapsed more dramatically than the stock market itself, and it set the stage for the public disclosure rules that mutual funds have since followed. One critic of secrecy among the closed-end trusts was Paul Cabot, who founded an open-end fund called State Street Investment Company. Writing in the Atlantic Monthly in early 1929, Cabot warned,
"There are two common abuses to which the investment trust is now being put. First, that of being run for ulterior motives, and not primarily for the best interests of the shareholders. Second, that of being used as a depository for securities that might otherwise be unmarketable. When a trust says it is formed to accomplish one thing, and then attempts to do another, it becomes an abuse."
After the crash, investor sentiment turned from giddy enthusiasm to complete suspicion. For over a decade, no new closed-end trust was formed. Shares in the funds that survived were sold at deep discounts to their net asset value. And the practice of discounting closed-end share prices grew out of the circumstances of the 1930s. By comparison, the open-end investment trusts were largely untainted by scandal, and they managed to survive. Nevertheless, the entire concept of professional money management languished in disrepute throughout the 1930s. In 1940, Fred Swed, who had worked as a stockbroker on Wall Street during the 1920s, wrote a satirical book on the investment world. His title was taken from the age-old question, "Where are the customers' yachts?" Swed summarized the common view of investment trusts at the time.
"The basic idea of investment trusts is little short of perfect. But as we all know too well, in actual practice, American investment trusts have varied between the disappointing and the catastrophic. The whole subject makes an interesting study of the generous gap between theoretic promise and practical fulfillment. There has been a great deal of thoughtful, searching legislation against trust abuses in recent years, and all of it favors the investor. The sad thing is that there can be no legislation against stupidity. I should not care to entrust what I like to think of as my funds to a smart crook or an honest bonehead. But if I were forced to choose, I would choose the crook. With a writ of replevin and a policeman, I might be able to get back my money from the crook, but all there would be for me from the bonehead would be a heartfelt, even tearful apology."
From this low point in public opinion, industry leaders, including Paul Cabot, worked with the government to establish regulatory safeguards that would restore investor confidence. The result was the Investment Company Act of 1940, whose important points have been summarized by mutual fund legal expert William Baumel.
"The 1940 Act contains extensive disclosure requirements. In addition to a series of registration requirements, every investment company must distribute, at least semi-annually, a detailed report of the company's activities to its shareholders. These reports must contain information on the financial status of the fund, the securities held in the fund's portfolio, compensation paid to the directors, and purchases and sales of investment securities within the portfolio. The Act also dictates that certain management tasks be carried out by a board of directors, at least 40% of whose members are independent."
After the 1929 crash, disclosure requirements became the principal deterrent against the abuse of small, uninformed investors. However, the Investment Company Act of 1940 did also limit some investment activities of trust managers, particularly regarding buying on margin. Most observers in 1940 hailed the new regulations, including Business Week.
"This month, the country's investment trusts come under federal regulation, and they're happy enough about it, which might seem surprising to critics of the growing bureaucracy in Washington. Fact is, the law is a compromise, written in very large measure by the trusts. It imposes only such restrictions as any judicious and honest management would feel were essential in the conduct of its own affairs."
When the Investment Company Act of 1940 was passed, about 1% of the American population held approximately $400 million in assets in some 68 funds, a level significantly below the $8 billion in 755 trusts just before the Great Crash. From 1940 to 1950, the industry grew more than threefold to 1 million shareholder accounts, with assets growing fivefold to $2 billion. The post-war bull market of the 1950s and 1960s then sparked a new fascination with the stock market, bringing a new generation of small investors to the market. And this new generation in particular found mutual funds to be a useful tool for managing the stock market's rewards and its risks. The 1940s and 50s were a highly conservative era, and a heyday for what would later be called balanced funds, because the typical fund held roughly 50% bonds and 50% stocks. And even the stock portion of these funds was generally made up of conservative dividend-paying issues. At the same time, the industry started building a network of salespeople to sell fund shares in the same way that insurance policies were sold. Fund salespeople were compensated with the sales charge, or load, that typically ran 8.5%. During the 1950s, the term mutual fund came into popular use. Solid investment policies, combined with a healthy post-war stock market, largely erased the bad memories of investment trusts from the 1920s. The turnaround in attitude is expressed by Fred Schwed, who in 1955 revised his book entitled, Where Are the Customers' Yachts?
Mutual funds are rarely bought at an investor's whim. The management has hard-working and persuasive salesmen out, digging into new territory all over, not just in the stock-conscious coastal areas and big cities. They call on people and explain the advantages of their wares and answer questions. They call again if they are given any encouragement. They call again if they are not given any encouragement. They can properly compare to life insurance salesmen. You remember the life insurance guy. First he was a minor nuisance, then he became loathsome, then he pushed a policy down your throat. Then, a decade or two later, you view your policy fondly and congratulate yourself on being a responsible citizen and family man. The way things have gone for 15 years, it can easily be argued that mutual fund salesmen have done their reluctant clients an even greater boon than did the life insurance salesman. Anyway, so far.
The mutual fund found its footing as a trustworthy proxy, a kind of protective medium for small investors who were looking for access to the stock market. Mutual funds also started to feature managers who were implementing new investment theories. Among them was T. Rowe Price, known as the father of growth stocks. Price believed that stocks pass through a life cycle, similar to the human life cycle, in three phases of growth, maturity, and decline. For Price, a stock in its growth stage offered the best potential return. Price's investment approach and life were summarized in Barron's shortly after Price died in 1983.
In a three-part series of articles published in Barron's in 1939, T. Rowe Price suggested that people could make money in the stock market by avoiding decaying industries like the railroads and buying what he coined growth stocks. It was a radical notion. Most people assumed stocks rose and fell with the economic cycles, and when they reflected on the cycle they had just come through, buying common stocks hardly seemed like a good idea. But Price argued that growth stocks represented companies with earning power which could reward investors in the years ahead. Among his picks were Coca-Cola, J.C. Penney, IBM, and Procter & Gamble. In time, Price's name would become synonymous with the concept of growth stock investing. In 1950, after years of experimenting with his own portfolio, Price decided to offer the public a mutual fund composed only of growth stocks and not charge a sales fee, the beginning of the no-load mutual fund industry. He outlined his idea again in a series of articles in Barron's, and it was immediately successful.
Americans were regaining confidence in the U.S. stock market, and they also started to look abroad at foreign markets, both in post-war Europe and in new emerging markets. The mutual fund pioneer in this field was a Tennessee native who became a resident of the Bahamas and a British subject knighted by Queen Elizabeth II. Forbes writer Lawrence Menard summarizes the story of Sir John Templeton.
Way back in the 1950s, long before it became fashionable, or even conceivable to most people, Sir John Templeton and his Templeton funds were scouring the entire world of investment opportunities. Let others be hidebound in their beliefs that the U.S. was the only safe place to invest. Thus were the Templeton funds early and highly successful investors in Japan as far back as the mid-1960s, long before anyone thought that the island nation would become an economic powerhouse. In the early 1980s, Templeton invested heavily in Mexico, another astounding pioneering feat. This sense of global citizenship has served Templeton clients well. A $10,000 investment in the Templeton Growth Fund when it was started in 1954 has compounded to over $2.3 million by 1994. Compound rate of return over 40 years, 17% per annum.
Templeton's global perspective was later expanded into funds focused on specific countries. Other mutual fund managers with other successful perspectives emerged during the bull market following World War II. One was John Neff, whose career as the manager of the Windsor Fund was reviewed by Barron's in 1994, shortly before Neff retired.
To be great, Hemingway once said, you have to last. By that measure, John Neff is at the top of his class. Since he started with the Windsor Fund in 1964, it has multiplied in value some 45 times, or more than twice the value of the S&P 500. That enviable record has put Windsor first among mutual funds still managed by the same person. Like most successful investment strategies, Neff's is a simple one. Buy reliable blue chips with low price-earnings ratios and juicy dividend yields.
While Price, Templeton, Neff, and others were building the investment approaches that secured their reputations, the 1960s developed into a hot period of stock market speculation that in many ways rivaled the 1920s. Just as investors of the 1920s had described their moment in history as the Jazz Age, investors of the 1960s nicknamed their era the go-go years. At first, when everything was going well, the term go-go was spoken with a sense of fun, and the go-go years had yeah-yeah mutual funds to match. Financial historian Robert Sobel describes the atmosphere surrounding the go-go funds of the 1960s.
The generation of investors that grew up during the 1950s and 1960s thought funds were fairly stodgy. Certainly not the place to be for those seeking action. Then came a change that met the needs of speculators who wanted and were eager to accept more volatility. The bull market started to sizzle in the late 1960s, when Wall Street took on the appearance of a playground for hotshots, gunslingers in the parlance of the time, young men who spoke airily of achieving profits of 50 to 70% with a great degree of regularity. There was Fred Alger and the Alger Fund, Dave Mead who energized the Winfield Fund, Fred Carr and the Enterprise Fund, and a number of others.
Managers of the go-go funds brought a new round of speculation, and with it some outstanding returns of 50, 60, 70% or more in a single year. This created what became known as the performance cult. Investors who moved their money around to various funds, pursuing the hottest manager based on recent performance. The stellar return rates also made it easier to sell mutual fund shares, and the number of fund salesmen exploded. Many of these new salespeople worked part-time, literally selling fund shares door-to-door. One estimate has put the number of part-time salespeople at the end of the 1960s at more than 250,000, all working for the 8.5% sales load. The glamour of the fast-rising funds also made celebrities of fund managers. Foremost among them was Gerald Tsai, who first gained notice in the early 1960s as manager of the Fidelity Capital Fund. After leaving Fidelity in 1966, Tsai started his own fund, the Manhattan Fund, with much fanfare. His photo and story appeared in general interest magazines like Life and Newsweek. A 1965 issue of Business Week reflected the giddy enthusiasm for Tsai's fast profits.
If the securities business can be likened to the dress business in that it too thrives on fashion, then its hottest designer today is a 36-year-old Boston money manager, Gerald Tsai. He plays the market as if it were a fascinating, challenging game, and he plays it boldly. Unlike most fund managers, he works on a concentrated list of stocks, taking positions that are big in relation to the size of his funds, built up from scratch in 1958 to $240 million now. He moves in and out loosely, at times motivated chiefly by the action of charts. This has enabled him to catch the change of fashions or to set them, often enough to demand attention.
To maximize returns, go-go fund managers sometimes took large positions in small, thinly traded stocks. They bought illiquid securities, valued at a high price but essentially unmarketable. And they turned over the portfolio frequently to capture small capital gains. As we'll see, the go-go funds became very popular. But not all investors were impressed. One critic of the 1960s go-go funds was Paul Cabot, the 1929 critic of investment trusts, who now turned critic once again. Cabot told Forbes magazine in 1969 that conditions were more troublesome than 1929.
I don't argue with investing for performance. I'm for it. But investing for short-range performance like this is wrong. It's poor policy. It can actually lead to bad long-range performance. At State Street, we're willing to take risks, but not the kind where we're going to be blown right out of the window if something goes wrong.
Another critic was T. Rowe Price, the father of growth stocks. In 1969, Price reviewed his earlier success and warned,
"In 1959, the growth stocks got ridiculously high. So I decided that the thing then was to go into little companies that would become growth stocks, little companies in the early stages of growth. And now everybody is in the act. The next phase in the evolution of my investment philosophy has come in the last 2 years. I kept thinking that we're coming to the end of an era in the world, the end of a great boom. The signs are all around."
This is the end of Side 1. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.